All right, we've got just a few new faces in here. I'm Brent Lofgren from the NOAA Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I do climate modeling on a regional scale as a profession. And I'm trained in meteorology, but I do a fair amount of my work in hydrology, which is the science of how much water is available at a particular place and for a particular purpose. So I oscillate between some of those two, and one of my major concerns is water. And the topic of today's talk is, the title is hyperbole, intended to be provocative. So it's going to end up to say, yes, it does matter, but there are ways in which people have used temperature as a predictor of different things that don't quite work. And actually, the really specific example of that is part of my research is reserved more for tomorrow's talk. I'm going to sort of hint at it today. But we'll talk about it in greater detail tomorrow. So the outline of today's talk are technical and practical definitions of temperature, means of heat transfer, and then asking how is temperature distributed in the world around you, surfaces of different objects and landscapes versus in the air. How and where is it measured? Just very briefly about that. How does it affect you? We'll talk about what makes you feel hot or cold and what else affects how you experience temperature. So we'll talk a little bit about what is often referred to in the weather forecast as what temperature does it feel like. Okay, definitions. The practical thermodynamic definition is if one object is at higher temperature and is somehow in contact with another object, the energy is going to flow from the higher temperature to the lower temperature. The more technical definition, and this requires some knowledge of calculus, it's the derivative of entropy with respect to energy. And for those who really know this stuff, if you put that definition together with the second law of thermodynamics, I believe it is, that entropy always increases, the first definition really follows from that. So what you need to know is energy flows from higher temperature to lower temperature. And energy is never created nor destroyed. It can only be transferred or transformed from one form to another. One example of that is that any kind of fuel that you would use in a fire or in an engine contains chemical energy, and then when you burn it, there's a chemical reaction, and that releases heat. Light and heat are different forms of energy. So means of heat transfer, conduction is one of the forms, and when I was back in middle school, I guess maybe it was, they told me heat can be transferred by conduction, convection, and radiation. They gave me pretty good definitions of conduction and convection. Radiation, not quite so good. But conduction is direct contact of objects with given temperatures, and the individual molecules are just moving around in those, and in the hotter part, they're moving faster. but then they start bumping up against some of the molecules in the cooler parts, and that heat gets transferred. So if you or anything else touches something warmer, that thing or your part of your body is going to get warmer. Another means of heat transfer is convection, and we in meteorology actually make a distinction. Convection to us means moving in the vertical direction, and advection means moving in a horizontal direction. But for most people, there's not really that distinction. So this means if you have a group of molecules, a parcel of air is what it's often referred to as, and it moves from this side of the room over to that side of the room, that side of the room is going to more closely match the temperature from this side of the room. So winds and water currents can carry this temperature through convection and advection. And forced air or hot water heating systems work on this principle. And regularly near the surface of the Earth, there's a lot of mixing. So it's not just one mass of air moving in a particular direction, it's smaller masses stirring up. So that evens out the temperature throughout that whole region where that stirring is happening. Yeah, now radiation is the trickier one. So it's not the nuclear kind. It includes visible light, but is spread across many more wavelengths. So sunlight includes the visible light, and ultraviolet on the shorter wavelength, and what we call near infrared on the longer wavelength end. And then every object surrounding you is emitting invisible light in the long wave range. So everything is capable of absorbing and emitting radiation. How much and at what wavelengths? And don't worry too much about the terminology there. But when I say intermolecular structure, that basically means what phase of matter it's in. So solids and liquids are good at absorbing and emitting radiation. Gases, it depends. So in the case of gases, you're going to look at the molecular structure. And the main things that are in air are oxygen, O2, and nitrogen. Actually, in the opposite order, nitrogen is the first component, N2, and oxygen, O2. And they each have only two atoms in their structure. And one of the implications of that is they're not at all good at absorbing and emitting the kind of radiation that is important for the heat budget of the Earth. So other gases have more atoms in them, in each molecule. So H2O, CO2, CH4 is methane, and several other molecules are more complex. They can absorb and emit radiation at more wavelengths. So here's what I promised to those on who are here on Monday. This is the infrared giraffe. So giraffe is a solid object, and it has temperatures at different parts of its surface. The warmer temperatures are indicated by the red, and I guess maybe the white is even warmer than that. And then it's kind of tough to tell what some of the objects surrounding that giraffe are, but a lot of those are at cooler temperatures, not emitting as much. And then it's difficult to see the air because there's just not enough being emitted there. So as I mentioned before, people have capitalized on this emission of infrared radiation for military applications. You can seek out people at night when it's dark and you can't see them using visible light. They might show up using an infrared sensor, or vehicles also usually have heat coming off of them. So some other examples of heat transfer. I mentioned sunlight already, or if you have some sort of electric heating element, you'll get that powered up and it'll start glowing red hot. And some of that energy is in the visible wavelengths, the red, and others of it will be more invisible, but it's radiation that is going toward you out of that object. And often you put a reflector behind it to direct that radiation in a particular direction. An explosion a couple of years ago, I went to Las Vegas and the Mirage Hotel has the artificial volcano display and there are these explosions and you can just feel this sudden burst of heat coming at you, and that's from the radiation. And other things are less than red hot. They're not visible, but they're not emitting radiation in the visible wavelengths, but you can still kind of feel it off of there. Then this is less of a heat transfer. It's more of a transformation. Latent heat of evaporation of water is something that enters into the energy budget of a surface. So this is changing water from a liquid to a gas, and you have to input energy. And you have to input energy so that each of those molecules is going to just break out of that massive liquid and become an independent gas molecule that just bounces around through the air. So if you think of a boiling pot and you heat it up to the boiling point, you still have to keep adding energy to it in order to evaporate more of that water. It just because it's at that temperature, it doesn't all boil at once. So that's a manifestation of this need to have latent heat going into evaporation of water. And that's a major process within the whole Earth system. It's one of the consumers of heat at the surface. And then when that water gets into air that's cool enough, it's going to condense out of the atmosphere, and that's going to release that heat back into the atmosphere. And that's one of the major drivers of thunderstorms and hurricanes. They're just releasing that latent heat as the water is condensing that enters into those storms.
Really?
Yeah.
Kind of a silly question. I mean, evaporation occurs obviously in situations where the water is not a boiling point. At what point does evaporation stop?
It really doesn't stop. Basically, there needs to be a gradient in the amount of water vapor in the air. It's actually a lot like temperature in that respect. So you have to have a greater concentration of water vapor immediately at the surface than there is higher up by a little bit in order to have evaporation. And one of the things that can inhibit that is because it requires latent heat to happen, once you have some evaporation, that surface is going to cool down and there's going to be less water vapor right there at the surface. Okay. So that's really going to enter into tomorrow's talk as well. Okay, so how is temperature distributed in the world around you? All these things are exchanging heat among them. Nearly all of the heat originates from the sun and eventually escapes back to outer space. Greenhouse gases inhibit that process, but it does eventually get to outer space. So then I showed this picture on Monday before, and this gives you an idea of the spaghetti pathways that a lot of these processes take. So you've got exchanges of energy between the Earth system and the outer space at the top, characteristics of the atmosphere, next rung down, exchanges between the atmosphere and the surface in the ovals closer to the bottom, and then characteristics of the surface at the bottom. So, yeah, surface temperature has an influence on latent heat or evaporation. So that's what you were sort of asking about. And some of these are exchanges of energy, some are exchanges of water, but they're all linked together.
What's the term SFC at the bottom of the slide?
Surface.
Surface temperature.
Yeah.
That's albedo.
Oh, yeah. That question came up before. Albedo is the percentage of sunlight that's reflected from the surface. So ocean surfaces have some of the lowest albedo on the Earth, and forests are kind of next lower. Deserts are higher, and snow-covered and ice-covered.
The ice cap and the Arctic ice cap is one, but then when it gets melts as water, it's reflective, it goes way down.
Yeah, whether there's ice floating on it makes a big difference in the albedo.
That's sort of counterintuitive. Anybody that's sort of been along the shore and, on a nice sunny day, there's a fair amount of glare off of...
If you're looking at the sun at a particular angle, you can get a lot of glare off of it. One of the main reasons for that is that you can look at a water surface, and it's much smoother. So if you look at it at a particular angle, you'll get that sunlight reflecting directly at you. Mm-hmm. Most land surfaces are rough, so that the sunlight that's reflected off of them scatters, and it won't be concentrated in just one direction.
The term friction, what would be an example of that?
I guess wind being dissipated by a stand of trees would be one. So, yeah, it's interacting with the elements of those trees so that you don't have as strong a wind right there.
Wouldn't like longer wavelength the radiation actually not reflect off the water? You just see more of the shorter wavelength anyway. Reflecting.
I guess within the solar spectrum, are you talking, or the?
Like the stuff you can't see, I would imagine would probably absorb better in water than.
I don't think there's really a relation like that. It's. Forgotten how that works, but I don't think there's really a strong effect along those lines. And I'm going to go quickly through these next few slides. It's just these processes are working in the atmosphere, transferring heat around through various means, at the surface as well. Atmosphere exchanging with different types of surfaces, water, vegetation, soil, and man-made landscapes. And then the boundary layer is the part that really interfaces between the atmosphere and the surface, and that's really important for conveying both sensible heat and latent heat or water vapor between the surface and the larger part of the atmosphere. But one of the other important things that happens in the boundary layer is it often has clouds. So if you see stratus clouds, just a flat layer of clouds, that pretty much always marks the top of the boundary layer. Even if it's not a solid deck of clouds, if it's kind of broken, it still marks the top of the boundary layer. So this is kind of a summary of what's going on at the surface. The yellow is showing the energy from sunlight. So it's coming in, some of it reaches the ground, some of it bounces back, the albedo. Some of it bounces off of clouds. So that's also considered albedo, but it's not part of the surface albedo. And some of it will bounce off of gases in the atmosphere as well. Some of it will be absorbed in the atmosphere. Now the long wave, like what was emitted by the giraffe, some of that can come from clouds or gases in the atmosphere. This is the actual greenhouse effect right here. And a reminder here that there's both the natural part of the greenhouse effect and the man-made part of it. So both of those are included here. And then some of it is sent upward from the surface, and some of it is sent upward from the atmosphere out into space. Latent heat flux of evaporation is over here. And then sensible heat flux is just, that's a direct transfer of heat from the surface by conduction and then into the boundary layer and into the larger atmosphere. And then there's also this conduction into the ground, and that's usually a small term, especially when averaged over, say, more than a day. So now if you look at some different types of surfaces, and these are both pretty natural surfaces. One is a dry, sunny landscape over here, and the other is a lawn with shade. And I told you about our public relations officer who gave me those beach balls that I was distributing earlier. She's the one on the right in that picture. There's going to be a very different temperature to the surface in these two cases. So you've got all that sunlight coming in on the left, and it needs to have increasing temperature at the surface in order to support outward fluxes of heat via long wave radiation. And since it's dry, there's probably not going to be very much latent heat, so sensible heat flux will predominate there. But on the right, you've got more of a shaded situation, less sunlight coming in. The surface temperature is going to be much lower, and you need to transfer less energy into the atmosphere. So one of the things on the left here is that the surface itself will be very hot. A little bit higher up, there's likely to be a strong gradient in temperature between the surface and, say, a couple of meters further up, but that temperature will also be warm. And then in the right, you can see there's one area that's shade and another that actually is sunny. So especially at the surface, there's going to be a difference in temperature between those two. A little bit higher up in the air, there's likely to be less of a difference between the two because that air is mixing up and equalizing that temperature somewhat. And one of the places I visited a couple of weeks ago, yeah, John.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but what's the contrast between long wave radiation and conduction, or how do they compare?
Oh, in amount?
Just long wave radiation, just generally, and conduction radiation.
I'm trying to get...
It's the heat transfer. You showed in the prior graphic the shortwave from the sun and the
long wave. Yeah, the conduction is carried by individual molecules. So if some of the molecules from the these blades of grass or the soil itself in here come in contact with molecules from the air, that'll be the conduction. Sensible heat flux is what we usually call it. But this soil here is also putting out radiation. So it's like sunlight, but at different wavelengths.
Okay.
So it's not being carried by any material. It's just traveling through space.
Yeah.
Is it timely to ask you now, or maybe you're going to talk about it at some point, but the tree reminded me that, what I read about the concern about our global warming is that the forests are being cut down. I can see the big forests in Brazil, and they're cut down. So I thought, there's a difference then in how the heat is transferring, right? Do you want to talk about that?
Well, that's probably more of a secondary effect.
Uh-huh.
And what's of greater concern in that case with the cutting down of forests in Brazil is that directly contributes to the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Okay, is that what you were saying?
No, but I think just to add to what you're saying is that the trees would normally take up carbon dioxide, so it would take them down.
Okay.
And you're no longer taking it down.
All right. I'm going to say number one is by cutting down trees and... usually they burn them, but sometimes they'll allow them to rot. Either way, either faster or slower, you're going to directly put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You're going to have fewer large plants that are able to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. You can replant them and... eventually get some of that carbon dioxide out, but it takes a long time.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it not true that the young trees that have been planted and are just growing are far better at dealing with carbon dioxide than older trees? So in a sense, forest replanting is actively replanting is very essential because the young trees growing do a much better job of sort of mitigating carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than older trees do, right?
Yeah, well, in proportion to their existing mass, probably yes, but...
I remember years ago there were some people proposing, well, let's cut down the old growth forests and replant new trees because they're better at it. Yes, new trees, I think you're right, do sequester carbon very efficiently, but by taking down the old growth, you're, like Brent said, you're releasing all that carbon back into the atmosphere, so we don't want to cut down old growth to be replanting it.
I don't think my question indicated an advice to cut down all the old growth to make that happen. But replanting, basically... it has to be very essential to do that.
Yeah, I'm thinking of some other things, but maybe I'll get back to those later. So one of the places I visited the week before last, and it's actually tough to get admitted to visit this particular one, but there are other places where they have green roofs, and this was the Chicago City Hall. And in actuality, there's one building where one side of it is the city of Chicago, and the other side is the county. And the city side of it has a green roof, and the county side until this year, they had a, I don't know whether it was asphalt or what, but it was black in color. So they said they had a sunny day when the official temperature was 90 degrees for the region, and they put a thermometer, and I'm guessing they put it very close to the surface of both sides of this roof, and the green roof side of it read 90 degrees Fahrenheit. The black roof with nothing growing on it, 170 degrees. Yeah. So neither of those places would be where you cite a official temperature reading, which is what I'm going to show you next. Just picture of this is what's about to get this award. This is the Holden Village weather measurement site. So at an official measurement site like this, the can-like thing on the right is the rain gauge, and I believe the cylindrical thing on the upper left is a humidity sensor, and the actual thermometer is inside that white box, which has vents on all sides. I don't know if it actually has a powered fan in there, but when it's hot, people say so many degrees in the shade to sort of emphasize that, but an official temperature measurement is always in the shade. It's inside a white wooden box like that, and it's 2 meters above the surface. And this seems like a kind of middling good site. Some of the problems with it are the stairs on the right are the stairs out of the snack bar, and Narnia is kind of off to the left. You're looking toward the creek, and it's a little bit of a problem with this site that buildings are as close and that trees are as close as they are. A usual site would be in a flat, grassy area. And if it's really close to a building, there's going to be a lot of heat during certain times of the day that give you an inaccurate temperature reading.
What is the white box? What's the material the white box is made of?
It's just a wood box, and it's got kind of louvers on the side so that air can flow through there.
Okay, so it wouldn't be metal, of course.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How is this red?
Ooh. How is it red?
Okay.
There's a radio transmitter in there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right, so this is heat exchange from your body. Or,
that's a candle.
So actually, it's quite similar to... at an Earth surface, you might have some sunlight coming in or other sources of light. You'll have exchange of long-wave radiation. And down at the bottom is evaporation and sensible heat flux, exchange with the environment. And then the one that's different is metabolism. And that's a heat source from inside your body, since we're warm-blooded creatures. So what you're really going to experience as being hot or cold is what is the temperature right at your skin. And that's going to depend on the balance of those factors of heat going in and out of your skin. So how much heat you're losing from your skin is what does it. Air temperature, although important, it's not the only factor contributing to this. So it's not that it doesn't matter, but it's not the only thing. At cold extremes, you can get hypothermia and frostbite. Anyone want to explain the difference between those?
Hypothermia is a lowering of the core body temperature.
Yeah, and frostbite is?
Freezing extremities.
Yeah, yeah. So frostbite usually happens in the extremities, and it's it requires a lower temperature to achieve that, but hypothermia really affects your whole body system. It's a lowering of your core temperature. And heat extremes, heat exhaustion or heat stroke, these kind of parallel those other two. Heat exhaustion or heat stroke is too high of a core temperature, and a burn is a very high temperature at one particular point in your body. And sunburn is really different. That's damage to the cells from ultraviolet rays, and it's a different mechanism. So going back to this diagram, what are ways that you might change some of these factors in how you're exchanging heat with the environment? Let's start with the sunlight part of it.
Put some clothes on.
Yeah, and it depends on what color the clothes are.
Yeah.
So dark colors absorb sunlight, light colors reflect it. Long wave and sensible heat kind of go together, so what are some ways of altering that?
Increasing water. I mean, either water vapor or just water to...
Yeah, that's actually the evaporation or the latent heat flux. So changes in the humidity of your environment will affect that, and we'll get back to that. So that's an important consideration. Yeah, we'll be talking about that a little bit later.
You asked about long wave. You could turn on the heater or something like that.
Yeah, if you have an external heat source, that might emit some long wave radiation. If it's like an electrical one, it'll give you some red light and some infrared.
Would layering,
so that's an input.
Layering help a little bit?
Yeah, clothes, insulation. Mm-hmm. That's really what I was after. So that cuts down on the outward exchange, net exchange of long wave flux and sensible heat flux. So if you put on a coat or some sort of warm clothes, and even when I was a kid, when I'd hear people say warm clothes, warm blankets, that sort of thing, I'd say, they're not warm, they're insulative. Mm-hmm. And it's the person inside of them that's warm.
I bet your mother loved that.
So, insulation reduces convection into the air near your skin, the sensible heat flux. I won't go over all those details. Also reduces loss to radiation, and especially with a metallic reflective component. If you've got a cooler that's metallic, that's one of the points of that. And I said latent heat loss can also be reduced, but possible complications, and what I'm really referring to for that is if you start sweating in a down coat or whatever, you're going to reduce the insulative effect of it. And yeah, actually, let's back up and talk about metabolism a little bit. One of the ways that you can increase that is by exercise, and that'll warm you up too. So, wind chill. Crookston, Minnesota is my hometown, and that used to have the coldest wind chill in the lower 48. It's since been broken, and actually there's been a replacement of the formula for calculating wind chill since that time as well. But wind increases the amount of loss of air from sensible heat flux. Really not that much effect on radiation or latent heat, but it can result in frostbite or hypothermia, depending upon how long you're exposed and how directly one particular part of your body might be exposed. Humidity effects. This is what cuts down on the amount of heat you can lose to latent heat. So physiological response to heat is to start sweating. And that'll evaporate and give you latent heat loss. But if it's humid, you're not losing as much heat to that. And second bullet point here, high humidity also keeps actual air temperatures higher at night. And that's a manifestation of the greenhouse effect. And I primarily think of the natural greenhouse effect when I'm saying that, but that can be enhanced by warming from man-made gases as well. And they say it's a dry heat, so it's not as bad, and this is the reason why. But watch out for dehydration. So getting back to some of the ideas of how does temperature affect various potential impacts and thinking about climate change caused by humans, I gave an example of things like hatching time of insects might be controlled by the amount of hours of sunlight rather than temperature. And hours of sunlight is a function of season and latitude, not temperature itself. But you might find that it's correlated with temperature. So that might cause you some confusion. If you assume that temperature is the actual cause, you might be wrong. And so there are going to be some things where time of year is really the key cause, some other things where temperature might actually be the cause. And it's difficult for people looking at impacts of climate change sometimes to distinguish between these two. And the primary example that, that I've been looking at is evaporation of water from land surfaces, in particular surrounding the Great Lakes. And people have been misled about what effect temperature, air temperature, has on that. So it requires an understanding of the complete budget of energy at the surface, like we've been talking about. And I'm going to talk more about that tomorrow and present the parable of Ole the supermarket manager. So you can look forward to that. But next is, why are people so insistent and stuck on looking at this in terms of air temperature? Because it's what you're used to. It's one of the easiest things to measure. It's the most evident part of climate change. And there's a legacy of using air temperature to measure different things, like evapotranspiration from the land. And I'm advertising the extra credit session. So practical demonstrations of heat exchange from your skin, and I'm also going to look at what is the meaning of mellow heat. People talk about mellow heat in a sauna, and what is a flame as well. And this will happen after the weather dance, approximately 9:45 in the sauna.
Can you get us all in there?
This whole group of people, I think, could squeeze in really tightly in there.
Effectively demonstrate. You'll demonstrate.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you. We'll look at heat exchange in a dry sauna, and then in a steamy sauna, and in the plunge pool.
Are you going to have reporters from that group to come to your next class?
From which group?
From your group of people that are going to be experiencing this extra credit session.
Probably so, yeah.
I would say survivors, not reporters.
So, well, the example you used was insect hatch in terms of daylight, temperature. Mm-hmm. What's the deal with blooming, you know, like fruit trees? Is that a daylight or temperature or both?
Yeah. Actually, there's a good example of that in Michigan this year. The tart cherries are a major product of northwestern lower Michigan, mm-hmm. and they apparently do have largely a temperature dependence. And what happened this year was we had several 80 degree days in March, and the cherry trees came out of dormancy, mm-hmm. started sprouting leaves, and then it got cold again. Mm-hmm. And there's been basically no cherry crop there. So in that case, there appears to be a temperature dependency.
Well, thank you for all your good news.
So yeah, in that case though, what it really took was first the warm temperature, then the cold temperature to be a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it also probably affected the bee population.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it did to the bee population.
Mm-hmm. Or the pollination piece.
Yeah, I think those trees didn't get to the point of...
Well, they didn't even get blossomed.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Just
bud break.
Yeah. Anything else? All right. Uncharacteristically quiet.
Thank you.
Very good.
Yes.